I wanted to raise a question of what are the limits of the things that are verifiable? I mean, what you've talked about says that various phases of relative existence and absolute being are all verifiable experiences that we can experience for ourselves. But for example, the notion of karma seems to me to be essentially completely unverifiable, because the universe being as complicated as it is, there being so many interactions between individuals and all kinds of material, that it would be possible to say that any sequence of events were due to karma without the possibility of contradiction. Therefore, it seems to me that this is not part of the same kind of, if you like, scientific exposition as the discussion of transcendental meditation itself. There's another concept which it seems to me falls into the same category, and that is that of the three gunas. The idea that there is something which involves the process of creation clearly has to be there. But this precise question of how you logically divide it and describe it as partly creative, partly destructive, partly this, that is difficult to verify because it acts all at once. And therefore, you can never chop it up and say, I am just observing the one, just observing the other. It seems to me an example of this is just the contrast in the description of the three gunas in your lectures and in the book you wrote, the commentary on the Gita, in which tamas guna, for example, is described as a maintaining principle which maintains a certain state. These words appear explicitly, and I can show where they are on, in fact, page 92. Yes, but what it says there, for example, and which makes just as much sense to a naive reader, is that it is the principle of maintaining of a state so that it is ready to evolve into the next state by the action of sattva. Now, page 92, it appears completely explicitly on that page. Now, the point I'm getting at is it doesn't matter whether there is a contradiction or whether these two can be put together, but the whole concept, the division of the process of evolution into three gunas, is really an intellectual division rather than one which can be experienced. Therefore, it seems to me that both in these, in both of these areas, the area of karma and the area of this discussion of the three gunas, that it is important to draw a distinction between what are very useful intellectual descriptions and what are verifiable experience, personal experience.
I would say your viewpoint on karma is very intelligent, because the area of influence of a karma is so vast that, and then so complex. Each time we are thinking, and each thought is influencing the whole creation, and another thought influencing the whole creation, and another thought influencing the whole creation. It's such complex. But when we come to the ability of perception, even though it is vast, it could be perceived. Because anything, be it very fine and complicated, but as long as it is within the range of relative existence, if our machinery of experience is sharp enough to maintain the absolute all the time, then nothing could be unfathomable in the field of relative life. Even though for all practical purposes it is said the influence of karma is unfathomable, in spite of that, it is possible to experience all the details of karma if one wants and if one has the ability to do so. Similar is the case with the three gunas. It's not an intellectual inception to understand about the basis, finest relative basis of all manifested life. It is a reality of existence. The three gunas, you rightly pointed out that because the three have to be together, how it is possible to know that they are three? We know them by their being predominant. The three have to be together. But the overall tendency of action, either dominated by sattva or dominated by tamas or dominated by rajas, by which it is dominated, even though for the practical purpose of experience, it is possible to experience the three gunas, 1, 2, 3. In their yet unmanifest state. Because in their equilibrium, they are non-active. Yet they are in the manifested region of life, first manifested. They have not yet started to display their activity, yet they are said to be in perfect equilibrium, and that is said to be unmanifest state of the nature of the absolute prakriti, the unmanifest state, and then from unmanifest state the manifestation starts. Manifestation starts means the three gunas, which are now in equilibrium, start losing their equilibrium. The tamas starts to function, sattva starts to function, their activity starts. So, the description of the three gunas, that is three tendencies at the basis of all relative creation, is a directly verifiable reality. It's not an intellectual conception. Intellect could have conceived one element, why three, could have element 4 or 5. It's not an intellectual conception. This narration comes from the direct experience. It is verifiable. And it is verifiable in the same course of experience which we take to experience the absolute, fine, fine, finer, finest, and the transcendental absolute. So it is true that the experience of the three gunas is the finest experience, and it must need a very fine, very refined ability of perception, most normally functioning nervous system. And it is true that the range of influence of action is terribly complex and vast as the whole cosmos. And therefore, we will agree that it is very, very, very difficult to experience the whole range of influence of a karma. But when it comes to the possibility of experience, we would yield to it, say, yes, it is possible to experience. Both ways. Once we agree for the possibility of cosmic consciousness, that means we can hold on absolute reality. Hold on absolute reality means the experience of it all the time, continuously. Then, on this level, we accept the possibility of any fine experience. The possibility we will accept.
It was stated that the three gunas had action in time. It was stated that the three gunas have action in space, but it was not stated that the three gunas have action in the field, the third field of action of the three gunas, which is the field of manifestation. And in these three aspects, the three gunas being the link between relativity and the absolute, is it conceivable that we could have chaos with transcendental meditation?
The whole relative life is chaotic. What is of value is that eternal harmony is the basis of all this variety and chaotic life. We are concerned with transcendental meditation and its scientific nature. As leaders of the movement, we are not concerned with karma and with three gunas and all. We start talking about it here because some of you have heard these terms and want to know what it is all about. So when we start discussing, we make clarify what karma is and all that. No? Otherwise, it's not our purpose. Our purpose is to combine the infinite with the relative, and that's it, transcendental meditation. But because these terms have been heard here and there, it's no harm knowing a little bit about them. That's all, that is our purpose.
Could the question about nature of this being only...
There are various theories of creation, and we are prepared to accept every one of them. Because what we find in creation is a big variety. When there is such a big variety, maybe some of it was created in this way, some of it was created in this way, some of it. All kinds of contradictory theories of creation we are prepared to accept because we see such diversity in creation. It could be that something was created in this way, something was created in this way. What we are concerned with is getting to the root of creation and starting to imbibe that infinite cosmic intelligence. That's it. It is not our purpose to find out how it was created. It is our purpose to enjoy the maximum in this creation. Create maximum, live maximum of life. And in the evening, in the morning, there were quite a lot of things. We said we would discuss various other types of such systems we were discussing. Who knows of some other systems? Yes? It's good to know what is going on in the air.
There's a group spreading very, very rapidly across this country, which is also very, very large in Japan. There's about 16 million people practicing this in Japan. It's called Soka Gakkai Buddhism. The people do a chant. It's called
The sound is Nam Myoho Renge Kyo. They chant this sound over and over and over again and rub beads together. They chant to this thing they call Gohansen. It's a scroll that comes from Japan, and they put it up on their wall and they chant to it. And they chant for whatever it is that they desire. They chant for a car. And comes in time, a car comes. And they found this to be a very working science, that they chant, girl standing on the sidewalk needs a ride. She takes out her beads and starts chanting, and she gets a ride to where she's going. I've attended their meetings, and the people seem to show a great energy, a great happiness, and a great lack of inner peace. And I'm concerned that these people are somehow consciously directing their own karma. I don't know exactly how to word it or how to explain it, but it seems like some dangerous thing that they might be doing, chanting for certain things and then them coming into being. And I'm very concerned for my friends who are involved in it. Even though outwardly the experiences seem to be good, the people become more energetic and seem to be more lively and more active. They don't seem to be peaceful at all. They're very, very intense, smoking lots of cigarettes and things like that. And there are many, many people, and it's spreading very, very, very quickly. They just grab people, and they say, you must come to the meeting. And they pull you in, and they start chanting, and then before you know it, you're chanting. I've seen them do it. They really do. They just grab people off the street and what like that. It's the third largest political party in Japan at this time, and they've just formed a political party in San Francisco. So what wisdom can we pass on to these people?
We can appreciate good results coming out of it, but we can tell them we have a system of doing less and accomplishing more. Rather than doing more and accomplishing something, all their agitation, lack of peace is due to the exertion that they put in chanting, repeating. They get so tired. So we don't have to get so tired. We should tell them that whatever they are enjoying is very well welcome, but they can enjoy the same, if not more, by simultaneously gaining relaxation. Instead of accumulating stress, gain relaxation and enjoy the support of nature. It's very good. And then we can tell them that probably they are not aware that the thought force is greater in the subtle regions of thinking, and the thought force is less in the grosser regions of speech. So if they are getting these results by loud repetition of certain chants, they can get much more effective results by repeating it in the subtle. So the skill of gaining efficiency in the chanting of subtle type, they must start meditation. And having gained mastery in this transcendental meditation, if they like, they are welcome to go and chant things like that. But gain the efficiency of this and see how the nature begins to support and all that. But we always appreciate whatever good point a system may have. If they say, you'll get this and you'll get this, he said, fine, this is also welcome and this is also welcome. But let us analyze into the process of gaining this. If the process is exhausting and like that process of minimizing the coordination between mind and body by inviting some spirits and all that, then we say this aspect is a little bit weak and therefore, but we can always have something to appreciate in any system, no. Whatever the system, we will find some good point in it and start appreciating it. First appreciation, and then closely examining it with our friend. Then he would know that we are not biased against him. We just not dismiss something that comes. Because we have been fascinated by transcendental meditation, because we have known it. He has been fascinated by that system because he has known it. He has not known transcendental meditation, so he can't suddenly accept it. He will advocate what he has known. We will advocate what we have known. But in order to make him listen to us, we must appreciate some point, whatever it may be. He say, yes, it must be wonderful if it is helping many people. And if many people are following, many people can't follow if it's nothing. So there must be something to it. So he knows that you are prepared to at least examine closely with him. There is nothing in this life which will not have any good quality. We always appreciate whatever may be good in a system. Every system, no matter what, will have some good points. Our first vision goes on those good points. We say, oh yes, you are fortunate to have this thing because of this, it's a very good thing. And then gradually, thinking aloud with him, we can come out to find the basis of that. And at the basis we can tell him, oh, here, transcendental meditation has a superiority. That's it. But we always appreciate the system. Every system has some value.
Wouldn't transcendental meditation be good karma, like a gift? You know, I've always felt that way. Someone who gets initiated, it's like a gift.
Very great gift, of course. Very great gift.
Okay.
There can't be a greater gift than transcendental meditation, because it relieves a man from the grip of all the possible bad karma. Talking in terms of karma, it's the very greatest gift that we can give to our dear ones. And that is the satisfaction to the leader of the movement, that he has been at least useful to some of his fellow men. What is known about Meher Baba? Huh? Someone who knows speak about him?
He says he's an avatar. Meher Baba says he's an avatar. The avatar.
He says he's avatar, or his followers say?
He says it.
What he is up to?
Meher Baba
says... He is an avatar. What he has come for?
Meher Baba says that in order to for enlightenment, we are to love him. And that's it. That's his whole bag. No, all you need to do is love Meher Baba, and then you're cool. You know.
Of course, one must love everyone, it's all good. Love is good. And,
Mayor Baba says that because he is the avatar and the direct incarnation of God, that by loving him, you therefore love God and therefore achieve God consciousness. That's what he said. Well, it doesn't make much sense to me. That's the reasoning behind it.
Right, he says the way through the avatar is the highest. Also, he says the way through the avatar is the highest in that the avatar takes over all of your personality. Also, it's stated that during the early experience, this is just a rumor, I suppose, but during the early experience of many people in transcendental meditation movement, they had visions of Baba and other such things. Also, it's stated that during the period of avataric manifestation, many saints arise. that because, you know, because many forms want to be manifest when the avatar is around, because, you know, they can get higher that way, that... Yeah, like, you know, everyone crowds in during an avataric period. It's said that during this time, many other movements like meditation would arise, and this is how they try to dismiss transcendental meditation. It's one aspect.
I am hearing such things about him.
Maharishi, Mayor Baba.
Maybe he, being avatar, thinks that I am his agent, born along with him to serve his cause. But I don't know about what he is up to.
Mayor Baba. Claims that when he was manifest on Earth for this particular time, that his duty is to usher in a new age of enlightenment. And he has not spoken for 42 years. Since 1925, he communicates with symbols, hands, and he says that when he speaks, it will be the primal ocean sound, Om, and it will be a great enlightenment for those who are ready, and it will be great physical destruction for those who are not. And it's, when he speaks, it's supposed to be at the very peak of chaos and hatred and away from God consciousness.
We can give him all the credit of the movement. No harm. There is absolutely no harm in giving him the credit. If he is the avatar of this age, fine. It's very good. Maybe from the astral plane he is conducting the movement. So that is all right. We are prepared to believe. We don't disbelieve things. Why? Maybe he is an avatar.
Go in the wrong direction, that this is the only way to attain that
we are on a path which can be conceived intellectually and verified experimentally. We will appreciate and adore all those who could give themselves up to someone in faith. Fine, very good. But this has been the fate of seekers for the last many, many centuries, all in terms of faith, unverifiable for results. Faith in God and faith in God and faith in God, and all suffering and weaknesses and chaos in life with faith in God. The time for such things is gone. I was told by someone in India, I don't actually remember the number, either 400 or 40, something like that. There are gods, 400 or 40 gods, who are the avatars now in this age in different areas of the world. So many gods are avatars.